the Biden administration put in place a new ban on evictions yesterday after a previous ban expired last weekend. The latest version is more limited. It bans evictions in counties with substantial or high transmission of the coronavirus through October 3rd. But President Biden says he expects to see the latest moratorium challenged in court, and he's expressed some doubts about whether the move would be considered constitutional. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about that, the bipartisan infrastructure deal, and more. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you want to see this eviction moratorium extended, or at least partly extended? Are you worried that the Biden administration may be acting unconstitutionally? Do you think the government should stop ending evictions right now at this point? And if you're close to this story, a landlord yourself, a renter, someone who's gone through eviction, love to hear your thoughts on this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Scott Wong is a senior reporter at The Hill. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Good to be back with you.
You've been watching this eviction moratorium. A lot of drama within Democratic ranks in Congress and the White House. What did we see leading up to this announcement from the White House?
Well, we saw a lot of finger-pointing among Democrats, namely from the White House to Capitol Hill and Capitol Hill back to the Biden administration. Lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers, including Nancy Pelosi, along with a number of progressive Democrats, didn't appreciate Biden sort of dropping this in their lap 2 days before this moratorium was set to expire. That would be last Saturday. The Biden administration said Congress needs to figure out a way to pass legislation to extend the moratorium that had been with us for a good part of this pandemic. That happened just as Congress was, the House specifically, was about to leave for their long summer recess. So this was sort of a last-minute thing. Pelosi gathered her lieutenants, huddled with Democrats. They thought about passing some legislation on the final day that they were going to be in session before that break, and decided that they could not do so. They could not come together to agree on something so quickly. Plus, there's the calculation that Senate Republicans would go ahead and block whatever House Democrats passed on the other side of the chamber. And so there was a lot of frustration, a lot of finger pointing. And ultimately, Pelosi gave an ultimatum to Joe Biden and the White House and said, look, we're leaving town. You guys need to figure out how to deal with this. This is going to be a huge crisis. And you guys need to unilaterally do something to extend the moratorium or create a new moratorium. And that's exactly what Joe Biden did.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about why the administration thinks it has the power to do this after some in the administration said it didn't have the power to do this. Here's what she said at a press briefing today.
What was announced yesterday was not an extension of the existing moratorium, which was, of course, national. It was a more limited moratorium that was going to be impacting and helping areas that were hardest hit by COVID.
Can you talk us through what this new moratorium, a partial moratorium, is, Scott?
Yeah, it's essentially a two-month new moratorium on evicting people from their apartments and homes, renters, who are unable to pay for their rent due to, you know, things that they're dealing with the pandemic, including job losses. It is more limited than the previous moratorium, but Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, said it would probably cover about 90% of the country. So almost everyone. The issue that Biden has referenced in his press conference yesterday was whether or not the Biden administration has the legal authority to do so, because the previous moratorium was struck down by the courts and ruled unconstitutional. And that decision was basically supported by the Supreme Court, which decided to allow the lower level courts to rule on that issue. And so Biden has raised concerns about the legality of this new moratorium. But in the meantime, while this will work its way through the courts, Democrats and the White House believe this will buy people more time to stay in their homes to prevent sort of a mass eviction of renters. And that should allow, Democrats hope, more of this $47 billion of rental assistance, rental aid that was already approved by Congress to get to the people who need it most. Out of that $47 billion, only $3 billion has been spent so far. And so there's enormous red tape that's preventing the money from getting into the hands of people who need it. And that's sort of what the hangup is with this housing crisis, getting the money into the hands of people who need it so that they can pay their rent and pay their landlords.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at the top stories in national politics, including right now a new partial moratorium on evictions. You can join in with your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Bill is with us in Upton. Bill, hi.
Good morning. How you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Bill?
Well, I agree with this person that's on the air with you that the Supreme Court already ruled on it. And I don't think the president or the administration has any grounds to stand on, in my opinion.
Bill, thanks for the call. And Scott, this is almost certainly going to be this new moratorium, almost certainly going to be tested in the courts, right?
Yeah, it almost certainly will, because you have thousands upon thousands of landlords, some of them not necessarily, you know, big corporations. Some of them are small landlords, people who own homes or apartments that are renting them out, and that's their livelihood. And if those people are not getting paid, there's a real concern from these landlords that they will have to file for bankruptcy of some sort. And so you could sort of see both sides of this equation. Look, nobody wants to be in this situation. It has been caused by a pandemic that we're all dealing with and have been dealing with for more than a year now. But the Biden people believe that this hopefully will buy them enough time to, now this $47 billion is already in state and local coffers. So that money's out the door. It's out of Washington. It's in states and cities. And now the challenge is figuring out how to get it to the people who need it most. There's a lot of just red tape and paperwork that people have been struggling to work through in order to apply for these funds. There's a lot of federal requirements. And so the charge from the president and from the Congress has been to make sure we prioritize, make sure the money is getting to the right people so that they can stay in their homes, not be put out on the streets, and that landlords also can get paid.
Is there any thought that Congress is going to go back and tackle this, I don't know, after a recess or something, or are they off the hook now with this moratorium?
Well, let's see what happens here. I mean, the reason why this got done this week is largely should be credited to a progressive freshman lawmaker named Cori Bush from Missouri. She, after Congress had gone home and sort of punted the issue back to the White House, Cori Bush decided to camp out on the steps of the Capitol for four straight nights protesting the inaction in Washington. She was joined by other leaders like Bernie Sanders and AOC. Chuck Schumer even dropped by to show his support for her cause. And it really galvanized Democrats and put enormous pressure on the White House, which ultimately did lead to this new moratorium. And so I think now this issue is front and center. If before it had been sort of on the back burner and not on the front pages of the newspapers and on the evening news, certainly it has caught everyone's attention and now is a top priority of the White House and lawmakers on Capitol Hill. And now there are, you know, national advocates who are keeping a close eye on this issue, including Cori Bush.
We're picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Scott Wong is with us from The Hill. We'll move on to some other issues in a bit. But first, let's hear from some of you on the moratorium on evictions. Billy is with us now in Madison. Billy, hi.
Hi. You know, I think the problem is that the system is broken. Everybody cares about the voter base. So you have someone that owns, let's say, 1,000 units, okay? One person, two people own 1,000 units. There's 1,100, 1,200 people that live there. Now, that's their voter base. They want to take care of those tenants. Tell them they don't have to pay rent. We'll take care of you. Well, that's, they only get a couple votes from that landlord, but they're getting 1,100, 1,200 votes from those tenants. I said, so that's what they're looking after here, the voter base. And that's all they care about.
Billy, thanks for the call. Scott, Billy perceives more interest on the side of the tenants, greater in number than the landlords. Has this been a concern in the debate over whether we should have this moratorium in the first place?
Well, I think the caller brings up a good point. I mean, you know, depending on the lawmaker, you know, they either could represent more tenants or they could side with the landlords. And you know, we sort of saw this week that some moderate Democrats who may be closely aligned with landlords from sort of conservative, you know, purplish districts, they were hesitant to extend the moratorium. And we saw that fight sort of playing out in the waning days before the House left for their recess. It was ultimately one of the drivers of why we did not see House Democrats take action legislatively to extend the moratorium, simply because there were moderates that are facing tough elections that perhaps received donations from a lot of landlord type constituents that are pro-business, who were reluctant to take that step and support a more long-term moratorium. And so, you know, you're seeing both sides of this issue, the landlord side and the tenant side, playing out and being represented by lawmakers in Congress.
Thanks for that call, Billy. We'll go to Dan now in Eau Claire. Dan, hi.
Hi, everybody. How you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Dan?
I have an idea of a plan that I think or something that could work. I guess I didn't realize that the money is out of federal government's hands, but even if it's at the states, why don't they just look at income tax returns from people from 2020, maybe 2021, but they're not out yet, and identify those who are low income. That's easy to do. And if they receive benefits from unemployment, that's easy to do. And there's many people out there who did not get this extra $600 a week, which, you know, is a lot of money when you add it up. There's a lot of people who had to quit jobs, had unsafe jobs, had jobs that they didn't feel were safe in the pandemic. Those people are left out in the cold and get nothing. Not everyone collected a bunch of unemployment compensation like a lot of conservative people tell them to, you know, go get a job. That just didn't happen.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, the concern now is streamlining those payments you mentioned earlier that are from the federal government in state and local hands, getting it to the people Dan's talking about who need it the most. Is that going to look different in every state, maybe every community?
I think so. And I think part of the challenge, if you think about, you know, the amount of money we're talking about, $47 billion was just dropped in the lap of states and counties and cities. And, you know, without a lot of guidance from the federal government. And I think a lot of these states and localities were not prepared to deal with, you know, the amount of money, the number of people that were seeking this help. So what Treasury Secretary Yellen has said this week to House Democrats on a phone call was that they are, you know, stepping up efforts to provide support to these states and cities to help them get the money to the right people, to, you know, build awareness about the program. In many cases, there were people who were unable to pay their rent, who were simply not aware that this money was available. In other cases, it was a matter of access. People needed computers to be able to fill out these forms and were struggling to provide all of the information that was needed to complete these forms. So, you know, there were a lot of hurdles. There have been a lot of hurdles in the way of people being able to complete the process and then accessing that money. It's difficult to do when people are trying to, you know, work multiple jobs and care for children at home. And you can see how this would not have been a priority, even though we're talking about people trying to keep a roof over their heads.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some top stories in national politics. Let's move now, Scott, to Ohio, to primary elections, part of special elections for open congressional seats. one among Democrats in a Democratic-leaning district, one among Republicans in a Republican-leaning district. A lot of attention on each. Let's start with that Republican one. Why are we paying so much attention to this race?
Well, we are paying a lot of attention to this race because of something that happened last week, and that was that a Trump-endorsed candidate, Susan Rice, down in Texas, was defeated by another Republican who was not endorsed by President Trump. That was in a special election to replace Ron Wright, who had passed away, unfortunately, of COVID. And so people were wondering whether this was just sort of a one-off thing or if there was a larger trend happening. And so we were watching the special election. And what happened in this case was the opposite. The Trump-endorsed candidate, Mike Carey, an energy lobbyist, came out on top of a pretty wide field. And so it's sort of unclear what the takeaway is. I think it's still really too early to tell. But we're going to be watching future special elections and other local races where Trump gets involved. Clearly, he is still the most dominant figure in Republican politics today. He's still the leader of the party, and he hasn't relinquished that. But it's going to take a little more time and a few more races to figure out if there's any larger trend happening within the Republican Party.
And another special election in Ohio watched as a battle between moderate establishment Democrats, however you want to call it, and the progressive wing of the party. What happened there?
Yeah, a little bit of an upset because you had the establishment-backed candidate, Chantel Brown, a local county councilor, defeat Nina Turner, who was a former co-chair of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, the progressive in that race. This was the race to replace Marsha Fudge, who became Biden's HUD secretary. And it just highlighted, you know, the longstanding battle between the establishment and the progressive wings of the party. You had a really interesting dynamic over the weekend. You saw the majority whip, James Clyburn, obviously representing the establishment, has served in Washington for decades, over the weekend stumping for Chantel Brown. Bernie Sanders, meanwhile, was across town stumping for Nina Turner. And so, you know, we saw this dynamic play out during the presidential race between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. Obviously, Biden, the establishment candidate, prevailed in that one. And so once again, in this particular race, you saw the establishment candidate prevail. But again, we have seen over the last couple election cycles, progressives have upset at key moments, have upset establishment candidates. In fact, one of the progressives we were discussing earlier, Cori Bush of Missouri, last year had defeated and upset the longtime congressman in St. Louis, Lacey Clay. And so that's one example where a progressive insurgent has come in and sort of stirred things up and upset the longstanding establishment candidate with a big name in politics.
I want to move on, Scott, to a sad story you've been following, a suicide, the fourth now, of a police officer who'd worked in the Capitol on January 6th. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, in fact, Rob, there were two officers who we learned about this week who took their own lives in recent weeks. One was Gunther Hashida, who apparently took his life last week. The other took his life last month. His name was Kyle DeFreitag. And both of them were not Capitol police officers. They were D.C. Metro police officers who were called to assist Capitol Police who were under attack at the Capitol that day on January 6th. There were dozens of Metro City police officers who helped and answered that call to protect and defend the Capitol. And as you mentioned, this is now the fourth officer who has taken his life. And it comes right after we heard from those officers who testified before the January 6th committee, really give emotional testimony about the toll, both the emotional toll, the psychological toll, as well as the physical toll that day took on them and continues to take on them and their families. So obviously our thoughts and prayers are with the families of these officers who who defended the Capitol on that day.
In our last minute or so, Scott, are you hearing conversations about making sure that officers who responded on that traumatic day are getting support that they need now?
You know, the support, as I understand, is available to these officers. I think what needs to happen now is more encouragement from the leadership, from the Congress, perhaps even the President of the United States to make clear that, you know, it's okay to ask for help, to get help. As I understand it, there is a support for these officers, especially those who were there on January 6th. But sadly, I think a lot of them continue, 7 months later, 8 months later to continue to deal with the after effects of what that day was on January 6th.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Scott Wong, senior reporter at The Hill. He was with us today for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. And hey, if you or someone you know is struggling with issues related to suicide, there is help out there. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255.